So, good morning, and thank you all for coming. So, in the previous lectures, particularly the last two, I've been talking about the way in which information is processed in the auditory system and the way in which successively transduction and amplification shape the signals that are then sent on to the brain. And today I want to turn to the last stage in the process, which is the way in which information is finally sent on into the nerve fibers. So sound energy is captured, transduced, amplified, and then finally there's an encoding step and the afferent nerve fibers carry information into the brain. The information has to be transmitted from the hair cell to the nerve fibers which surround its base. And there's a very specialized synaptic structure that does this. It's a class of synapse called a ribbon synapse that you see here. The name ribbon comes from the fact that these synapses are flattened ribbons in the visual system, that is in the retina. In the cochlea and in other hearing organs, they're instead spherical balls, such as this. As you can see, it's about 300 or 400 nanometers in diameter. The ribbon is surrounded by clear synaptic vesicles, which are about 30 nanometers in diameter. You occasionally see sites of vesicle fusion where the transmitter is being exocytosed. And the transmitter here is glutamate. The postsynaptic receptors are so-called AMPA-type receptors. So this is the terminal of an afferent nerve fiber. These are localized synapses scattered over the surface of the hair cell. And you can see that by placing in the hair cell a calcium indicator and then depolarizing the cell, say from minus 70 to minus 14 millivolts. A series of spots then light up where calcium is entering and exciting the fluorescent dye. If one takes one of these hot spots or spots of fluorescence and sections it in the electron microscope, one can see that this indeed corresponds to the position of the synaptic ribbon and the surrounding vesicles. So this suggests that the calcium channels that give rise to synaptic transmission are localized specifically at the sites of the ribbon synapses. It's possible to take advantage from that in doing electrical recordings from these cells after they've been isolated. So a hair cell such as this one can be enzymatically isolated. One can record from it with a whole cell pipette, but also one can record from a membrane patch with a tight seal electrode or a loose seal electrode like this, or one can even record specifically from the apex, the top end of the hair cell, and compare the currents there to those on the base. When one records the whole cell current, one finds that a depolarization produces a complex current with an inward and an outward component. And those can be separated pharmacologically into a calcium current, which is an L-type calcium current, and into a slow potassium current, which turns on with a certain delay. And this is carried through BK, or big potassium channels. Excuse me. One can also use the technique of ensemble variance or noise analysis to estimate the number of these channels. I mentioned this to you in an earlier lecture. The basic idea is that the relationship between the variance owing to a particular kind of current, that is the noise in the current traces, and the mean current ought to follow a parabolic relation. And you can see that the data, which are connected by lines here, fit that quite well. And from that, one can count about 1,800 calcium channels per hair cell. For the potassium channels, they're about 800 per cell based on the same type of analysis. One can also confirm the localization of both types of channels. One can see, in fact, that these hotspots, where we know they're synaptic ribbons, can even be seen in living cells with DIC, differential interference contrast microscopy. So it's then possible to place a pipette specifically on this presynaptic structure. And when one does that, one may see little or no current or various larger amounts of current at each particular position. So rarely you see three increments of current. More often, a couple of increments or just a single increment, suggesting that the current is coming in some sort of quantal units. And in fact, those quantal units seem to correspond to individual synapses. So in a single plane, a fluorescence imaging shows a number of these synaptic hotspots. And if one reconstructs the entire cell, you can count about 20 on average in each hair cell. Now, one can find those channels in the membrane surface by the technique of freeze fracture electron microscopy. So here is a freeze fracture of the base of a hair cell. This is the cytoplasm. This is the nucleus with nuclear pores studding it. Here are a few mitochondria and other large organelles. And on the exposed basal surface of the cell, we can see these membrane specializations with rows of particles. There's one here and one there. And at higher magnification, one sees the sites of vesicle endocytosis or exocytosis around the perimeter of the synapse. And then one sees a cluster of particles, large particles, on the relatively clear membrane space between. Now, dividing the total number of channels by the 20 synaptic sites, we can infer that there are about 90 calcium channels and about 40 potassium channels at each site, a total of 130. And indeed, the number of particles here averages 133. So there's a very good correspondence between the two numbers. So almost surely, these represent the calcium and potassium channels at the synapse. And recent work from Tobias Moser's laboratory in Göttingen has used high-resolution microscopic techniques, such as SED microscopy, to confirm that this is where the channels are indeed localized. It's also possible to take advantage of the geometry of this system to study the transfer of information across the synapse. So these are cells from an organ called the amphibian papilla. It is another organ with which frogs and other amphibians listen. These are individual hair cells, which are labeled with a particular antiserum against parvalbumin 3, a calcium buffer. You can see the hair bundle sticking out this end, or here, or here, or here. And the soma is this large bulbous red structure. These are nerve fibers, which have been labeled with an antiserum against sodium channels. And you can see when this organ is torn open a bit, one can see nicely exposed nerve terminals, such as this one or this one, which are big enough for recording. So it's possible to place one tight seal electrode and make whole cell recordings from the afferent nerve fiber at the same time as one makes recordings from the hair cell with a second pipette. Here is a living preparation just to give you an idea of the visualization that's possible. Here's the afferent nerve fiber, so one can place a pipette there. Here's an adjacent hair cell. One can place a whole cell pipette immediately adjacent to it. There are also supporting cells, and there are traces of some dead cells in the environment. So when one records from the postsynaptic nerve fiber, one sees this noisy activity. This is the resting current. Then there are these little segments of inward current, which represent excitatory postsynaptic currents owing to the release of glutamate. And one thing that's very striking about them is how irregular they are. If you look at spontaneous release in most synapses, you'll see a series of highly stereotyped, essentially identical inward current steps. But here, as you can see, some of them are bigger than others. Some are quite very large and are very complicated in shape. And this, I emphasize, is spontaneous activity. So it says there's something special about this synapse, that it's releasing a lot of transmitter at rest. In fact, we can confirm that that's the case. If we blocked the postsynaptic receptors, which are AMPA receptors, with the drug CNQX, or if we block the presynaptic calcium channels with nifedipine, either one arrests this postsynaptic activity. So this shows that it's indeed spontaneous but calcium-dependent activity that is exciting the postsynaptic cell. If we take a bunch of these records and blow them up and amplify the time scale, we can again see the very different shapes that they have and the different amplitudes. There's a reversal potential around 0 millivolts. There is some adaptation in these, or accommodation, which can be relieved by this drug that we often use, cyclothiazine, in order to block it just for the sake of simplicity of analysis. If we iontophoretically apply, that is, use a pipette to apply glutamate to individual synapses, and then use larger and larger and larger amounts of current, we get a maximum size of response. And that maximum size of response corresponds to about 150 glutamate receptors. So that seems to be a stereotype number of receptors under each synaptic terminal. Now, the most interesting thing with this type of synapse is that one can control the presynaptic voltage in the hair cell and measure the postsynaptic current in the nerve fiber. So these represent different depolarizations of the hair cell, and they are offset for the sake of clarity. But what we're looking at is the postsynaptic response. So when the cell is highly hyperpolarized, one can see occasional inward currents. They're small and they're of approximately the same size. And as we depolarize more and more, we see more and more currents, and we see the currents also getting larger. So there are some of these very big ones in a number of these traces. One can then make plots of the relationship between the presynaptic membrane potential and either the postsynaptic current or the presynaptic current. So in other words, we can measure the calcium current in the presynaptic cell, such as this current, and we can integrate the postsynaptic glutamate response in the postsynaptic cell. And when one plots either one of those normalized to unity, we see that the two graphs fall right on top of each other. So the triangles show the presynaptic, the circles show the postsynaptic response, and there's obviously a very close relation between them. So the relationship between the output of the synapse and the input of the synapse is highly linear, with a little nonlinearity down at the base. And this may be a useful feature for transmitting information to the afferent nerve fiber. It's not distorted, but it's very linear. Now, I've already alluded to the fact that these postsynaptic potentials are very irregular in size. There are some small ones like these. There are some that are much bigger. And as we depolarize more and more, the big ones become predominant. One way in which those might arise is if there are several small potentials happening at the same time. And indeed, we sometimes see that. If we blow up a signal such as this one, we may well see that it has on its rising phase the fusion of one, two, three events. This is a fusion, and so on. But most of the time, this is not the answer. And you can show that in different ways. One way is simply a statistical argument. If we take a trace such as this one, it has two small events, one event that's maybe twice as big, one event that might be three times as big. So I've labeled them one, two, and three. And if you simply divide this time into 200 microsecond bins and analyze the probability of an event occurring, we can say that the probability of an event in any particular interval is the sum of the total number of events, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, divided by the number of bins. So it's a very low probability in each bin. Therefore, the possibility that three events independently occurred simultaneously in one event, in one time window, is extremely small. It's p cubed. It's only a very small fraction of 1%. Similarly, the probability that there would be even a single triple event in all these intervals is 0.06%. So statistically, it just is not plausible that these large events arise from the fusion of accidentally synchronous small events. There must be something that links them together in time. The other way one can see that is to look at many such records and to capture those of a particular size class. So we capture those that are 100 plus or minus 2 picoamps, such as this one, or those that are around 50 picoamps or 200 picoamps. And then we plot the averages of those. And when we plot them and then normalize them, we see that they all fall along essentially the same curve. So it says that these small events have the same kinetics as the big events, even these very large ones. Again, this suggests they are not the fusion of individual events that happen to occur together, but rather there's some mechanism that causes large or small amounts of transmitter to be released. That mechanism depends on the presynaptic voltage. So if we hold the hair cell at a hyperpolarized potential, we get only the small events. If, on the other hand, we depolarize the cell or leave it unclamped, then we get a large number of these larger events. And you can see how much the events vary in size. For the small ones, the mean is about 50 or 55 picoamps. For the large one, the peak, the mode, is about twice that. And you can see there are some events that are as much as six times as big as this smaller event. So somehow, up to six different vesicle quanta can be released simultaneously. And the question is how that occurs. The other issue is, what are these quanta? Do they correspond, in fact, to the individual vesicles? Now, it should be the case that the relationship of the output to the input ought to be the relationship between the total postsynaptic charge that's measured by one electrode in the nerve fiber and the total presynaptic capacitance change owing to the fusion of vesicles on the presynaptic hair cell. So remember, each time a vesicle fuses, it adds a little bit of membrane, and we can measure that membrane addition as a capacitance change in the membrane. So these two values are equal to the value of a single charge owing to a single quantum released divided by the capacitance of an individual vesicle. And we can make estimates of several of these terms. We can estimate the capacitance of a vesicle because in many electron micrographs, we can easily measure the diameter of them. We know the capacitance of the membrane, and we can therefore infer the specific capacitance. And we can measure the other qualities in this kind of experiment. We depolarize the hair cell. We measure the presynaptic calcium current. And we measure simultaneously the postsynaptic membrane capacitance change. So before this depolarization, the membrane capacitance is here. After the depolarization, the capacitance is increased by that amount. At the same time, we can measure the excitatory postsynaptic current. And so that postsynaptic current is here, and its integral is shown here. So here is the increase in presynaptic capacitance, the increase in postsynaptic current. And putting those into this relationship, we've measured this two. We know the capacitance of an individual vesicle. We can estimate the quantal event that underlies this. And indeed, there's a nice linear relationship as expected. And the value is, again, 50 picoamps. So it says that the big signals, these guys, are made up of the synchronous release of many of these little ones. And it's still debatable how the synchronous release comes about. Here is a resting synapse. When the system becomes ready to release, there are three different possibilities. One is that these vesicles near the surface somehow become chemically competent to release. And then there's some cooperative mechanism that very rapidly causes them to go off together. A second possibility is that there's pre-fusion, that these yellow vesicles fuse into something bigger so that when release occurs, all of the content of 1, 2, 3, 4 vesicles comes out more or less at the same time. And finally, there might be some sequential release. It might be that when this first vesicle is triggered to release, it almost instantaneously triggers the second, third, and fourth to occur. And we and others are now doing experiments to try to understand how this occurs. This type of release with the large events seems to be important in synchronizing the afferent activity, and therefore important in the temporal precision of the auditory system. So we would really like to understand how this process occurs and what is the chemical basis of the biochemical basis of these rapid fusion steps. Now, I want to turn to a second problem related to the synapse, and that is the question of tuning at the synapse. If we record from neurons, in this case in the amphibian papilla, again the same organ of the frog, and measure the amplitude of the response as a function of frequency, and this is a log-log plot, one sees typically these so-called tuning curves with a sharp peak. And from the steepness of that peak, one can ask how many linear filters would it be necessary to have in order to produce that? And one finds that it would take 12 to 15 linear filters in order to produce such a sharp tuning. And this is very characteristic throughout the auditory system. Insofar as it's linear, there must be very sharp filters that produce these responses. Now, we know where some of those filters are. This is a schematic diagram of the amphibian papilla. The frog has an eardrum. There's a single bone called the columella that sends information in. There's a tectoid structure. It's sort of a jello or gelatinous structure that probably can carry some sort of traveling wave. There's a hair bundle, and there's several hundred hair cells, of course. And then finally, the individual hair cells have electrical tuning. They have calcium and potassium channels that tune them to particular frequencies. Each of these can produce probably about 2 orders of tuning. So there's mechanical resonance at this stage. There is a traveling wave of some sort here. We know that the active hair bundle motility, which is rather nonlinear, can produce at least a couple of orders of magnitude, a couple of orders of filtering. And finally, we know the electrical resonator has a couple of orders in it. We wanted, however, to explore whether there's also tuning at this last step of the synaptic transmission. That's never been described before. So to do that, we stimulated hair cells at a particular frequency. So here's the frequency of stimulation. Before and after that, we stimulated, we held the cell at a very negative potential and produced a high frequency signal with which we were able to estimate the membrane capacitance. So we measure the capacitance here, we measure the capacitance here, and those graphs are shown down below. Here's the capacitance before this depolarization and stimulation. Here it is after. And you can see that different frequencies, which I haven't labeled here, produce different amounts of response in terms of the capacitance change in the presynaptic hair cell. These are all modest size. This one is much more effective. In fact, if we make plots from individual cells at different positions along this organ, we find that near this rostral end, the front end of the organ, there is tuning of the synapse and the best release at a low frequency, around 200 hertz. As we move to the middle of the organ, the frequency shifts up towards 400 hertz. Towards the caudal end of the organ, the frequency goes still higher, near 600 hertz. So there's a very nice relationship between the frequency tuning and the position along the organ. Other investigators have previously estimated what nerve fibers that innervate this organ are sensitive to, and made plots of the frequency dependence from the caudal to the rostral end. And those plots are shown here in blue. This is the afferent nerve activity. So there's a tonotopic map with the caudal end over here representing these higher frequencies and the rostral end representing low frequencies. And our data show a reasonable agreement. The red points correspond to what we measure synaptically. So there seems to be a new sort of phenomenon here that hasn't been analyzed before, a frequency tuning owing specifically to the activity of the nerve fiber synaptic release. One wonders how this could occur, and here's a proposal. As you all, I'm sure, know, synaptic release involves a snare complex, an interaction among three proteins at least, that brings one synaptic vesicle close to the surface, and then upon activation with calcium, causes fusion to occur and the transmitter to come out. There's then a recycling. The snare complex is disassembled, a new snare complex is formed, and this process can be repeated. This process alone has no intrinsic timescale, or at least not a very strong one. There's a certain timescale associated with the timing of these biochemical steps, but certainly nothing resonant. But one can investigate the possibility of resonance under different conditions. Namely, if one has feed-forward effects or feedback effects, and whether they are positive or negative. So a positive feed-forward causes a stable system. There can be a possibly bistable system with a negative feed-forward. One gets stability with a negative feedback. But the interesting possibility is a positive or excitatory feedback that is a feedback rather than a feed-forward. So what this would correspond to is when one vesicle fuses, it somehow increases the probability of another vesicle fusing. It's a cooperative phenomenon. And indeed, if you analyze a model of that sort, it shows a sharp resonance owing to that cooperative behavior that's much stronger than the very weak increase that is found simply from the time constant alone. So we think that, in fact, the chemistry of the synaptic release may underlie this frequency tuning of particular fibers. So in addition to these four known mechanisms of frequency tuning, we've demonstrated a fifth one, synaptic tuning owing to the ribbon synapse. And of course, it's of interest to ask whether other structures in the brain or elsewhere that have highly repetitive frequency-dependent responses also have such tuning. The last remark about this is an interesting developmental question. If we have a series of filters, let's say 10 of them in a row, they can greatly sharpen the frequency response of a signal. So one filter tuned to this frequency, which might be 1 kilohertz or whatever you want, will give this response. If we have a second filter in series with it, the response is sharpened. And if we have a total of 10 such filters, the response is very sharp indeed. Here's a second filter tuned to a different frequency, say 3 kilohertz. Two such filters, and finally 10 such filters, produce a very sharp response. But if the filters are not tuned to the same frequency, there's a problem. Here's this filter tuned to the same frequency as the first one, and then it is attached to a filter that's tuned to this frequency, and the response is now very much smaller. And if we have 10 such filters at varying frequencies in between, we get almost no response at all. So it's really necessary during development that all of these filters be tuned to the same or very similar frequencies. And that's a challenge that we and others really haven't yet come to grips with at all. How does one ensure that the frequency of this mechanical structure, of the tectorial membrane vibration, of the hair cell's active process, of the hair cell's electrical tuning, and finally the hair cell's synapse, that all of those are tuned to very similar frequencies? One would like to think that there's some feedback. Maybe one of these determines the response and the others somehow sense it. But we have no idea as yet how that's done. And it's a very general problem throughout the auditory system, in our own auditory system as well. We have tuning at every level as we go up to the brain. Somehow that tuning all has to be kept in line in order to make the system fully effective. Excuse me. Now, in the remaining time, I'd like to turn to a developmental issue. This exquisite structure, the hair bundle that you've seen before, is very stereotyped. It always has this sort of conical shape. It has a short edge, and the stereocilia get progressively longer as you go across. And it has a striking polarity to it as a result of this beveled structure. Deflection in the positive direction causes always a depolarization. Deflection in the negative direction causes a hyperpolarization. So we would like to understand how the cell gets this elegant structure, and I can tell you we don't know at all. There's a second layer of organization that we're only beginning to understand, and that is that the individual hair bundles are not put down randomly, but there is a strong ordering in their position. So this vector, shown in red, represents the depolarizing vector, shown in the previous slide, the direction of maximum sensitivity. And you can see in this surface, which has some 2,000 hair cells, each represented by a white dot, that the hair bundles here are all oriented this way, then progressively shift through 180 degrees, and then they reverse direction and shift through another 180 degrees beyond this yellow line. So all possible orientations are represented, and this is useful because this organ, the sacculus, is responsive, among other things, to accelerations. So if I move in any particular direction, I want to have sensitivity to whatever acceleration vector happens to be most appropriate. So we would like to understand how this orientation occurs. And finally, there's a final layer of orientation that is important, in that the sacculus and the utriculus, this is the sacculus, this is the utriculus, are each oriented in different planes. So the sacculus is sensitive to vertical accelerations and front-to-back accelerations. The utriculus is sensitive to left-right or forward-backward accelerations. So the orientation of these organs is also key in understanding the different vectorial sensitivity. We've been investigating these issues using a simple model system, which is the larva of the zebrafish. At about 1 week of age, the zebrafish is only about 15 millimeters in length. It has an eye at this end and a swim bladder here. And along the side of the animal, there's some very accessible organs called the lateral line system. These organs can be labeled with a fluorescent dye so that you can see along the tail, there are about 10 of these organs down the side of the animal. These occur in pairs because the animal is transparent. So as you can see looking from below, you can look through the organ. Sometimes you see them out of alignment. Sometimes you see them in alignment between the two sides. Each of these organs is called a neuromast. And each neuromast looks like this. It has hair cells, shown here in red and blue. They're surrounded by supporting cells. And then finally, they're so-called mantle cells at the edge. The hair cells have short hair bundles with stereocilia and a long single kinocilium that extends up into this gelatinous structure called the cupula. So when the fish moves through water or water moves around the fish, this produces a force on the cupula. It deflects the cupula, that deflects the kinocilia, and finally they excite the hair cell by deflecting the stereocilia. Now, an important point about these is that each neuromast shows the vectorial sensitivity that I've already mentioned. You'll see that these two hair cells have their kinocilium to the right. They are sensitive to motion in that direction. These two are of the opposite polarization. They're sensitive to motion towards your left. And that is consistent from animal to animal and neuromast to neuromast. If we look at these in the electron microscope, you can see at a somewhat higher power the little hair bundles with the long kinocilia. And at a higher power, still, you can see the different polarities. So this hair bundle has stereocilia here and the kinocilium to your right. This hair bundle has the stereocilia here, the canocilium to your left. And there are other pairs across this organ. You can also see this polarization in a hair bundle that has been stained and looked at in the light microscope. Each of these bright arcs represents staining of the actin in the hair bundle stereocilia. The dark spot represents the position of the kinocilium, which does not contain actin, but rather tubulin. So these two cells, like the two red cells, are sensitive to the right. These two hair cells, like the two blue ones, are sensitive to the left. So this type of microscopy gives us an easy way of assessing the vectorial sensitivity of an individual neuromast and an individual cell. These neuromasts are produced by an interesting developmental process. There is a primordium, so-called, that originates behind the ear, and it walks along the length of the fish over a two-day period. And as the primordium progresses, it drops off clusters of cells called proneuromasts that then develop into individual neuromasts. Here's a movie of about 8 or 9 hours showing this primordium moving. And as it goes, it drops off a cluster of cells here, then a second cluster of cells here, and finally a third cluster of cells at this position. And you may have noticed that there's another neuromast moving on the opposite side of the transparent body. So this one out of focus is on the other side. It drops off a cluster of cells here, making a neuromast, which happens to be more or less in alignment with this one. And it drops another neuromast later. So this continues until this reaches the tail and deposits a total of about 10 neuromasts. Now, if we look at one neuromast as a function of time to examine the hair cells formation, we see something like this. I want you to notice at the outset this black cell at the bottom, because I'll come back to it later. Each of these is a pair of hair cells with green fluorescent protein in its interior, and this is another neuromast behind it. This cell that I showed you at the outset is now becoming green because it's destined to be a hair cell, and it will now undergo a mitosis into two cells, which will, like these, become hair cells that gradually separate from each other. So in fact, the cells are produced in pairs, and they're all produced in pairs. If we look early, we see only two hair cells, with this one oriented to your right, this one to the left. Here's a later stage with pairs of hair cells of opposite orientation. It's very clear here, there are four pairs, or here there are six pairs, and in every case, the canocilium of these is to your right, the canocilium of these is to your left. Finally, when the organ matures, it becomes more complicated. The cells become so squeezed together that the axes of polarity become ragged. And in addition, some cells begin to die. So near the middle in particular, you may find cells all of the same polarity with some polarity missing. So this is a very neat developmental system with two conveyor belts. There's a mechanism that with stem cells at the top, the North Pole, and one at the bottom, the South Pole. In each of those, there are so-called transit amplifying cells that are produced, and those are the cells that I showed you becoming green. That type of cell then undergoes a single division to produce two daughter cells, and they always produce mature hair cells of opposite polarity. Same thing from the bottom. The cells then move up along the conveyor belt towards the equator. There they age, and they finally die. And in the normal fish, it seems to take about 2 weeks for each cell to progress, to die, and then to be replaced. And this replacement goes on throughout life. So we're continuing studies now of this process, trying to learn more about particularly the stem cells that give rise to this process. Because obviously, in our population, 10% of us in France, in the United States, and elsewhere have significant hearing problems. And as I told you before, the hair cells that die are not replaced. So the most attractive mechanism of restoring hearing would be to regenerate hair cells, as can occur in this system. We would like to find what are the biochemical events, the molecular events, that underlie the production of new hair cells. Because if we could understand these steps in the fish or in other animals, we might be able to use that information to cause the same events to occur in a human. One way we're approaching this now is to try to document which cells are the stem cells and what the sequence of events is. And one way to do that is to use a technique many of you know called the Brainbow technique. This technique, which was developed by Josh Sains and colleagues, uses three different fluorescent indicators, three different fluorescent proteins, that are expressed in different cells and cause this beautiful panoply of different colors. So these are muscle cells. This has nothing to do with the talk, but it's such a pretty picture. And it shows very nicely the range of different colors you can produce. So the nice thing about the technique is it's a genetic change that causes each of these to have a different color. So all of the daughter cells, all of the progeny of one of these cells will retain that same color. So we're now doing such an analysis in the neuromast. We apply the Brainbow technique. All the cells start out red, but after a suitable treatment, some of them are switched to various other colors, this light blue, this purple, this different blue color, the various greens. And then all of the downstream cells, the daughter cells produced by division of any of these, will retain the same color. And we are now analyzing a preparation such as this to find out which are the stem cells and how the information flows from cell to cell. And in keeping with what I've told you already, we are seeing that these mantle cells, particularly those at the South Pole and the North Pole, are the ones that give rise to the cells that then move up and become the hair cells. But we haven't yet managed to document this in sufficient detail. The other thing we're doing is to analyze the genes involved in this process. We have fluorescent labels for the hair cells themselves driven by one type of promoter. So these are fluorescent hair cells. And we have a different marker that we've placed on the mantle cells, which we know is the population of stem cells. We can then separately analyze these cells by fluorescence-activated cell sorting and ask what genes are expressed, that is, what messages are present in these cells, or what genes are expressed specifically in these cells. And again, this is work in progress. There are far too many genes to make sense of at present. This shows an experiment in which we kill the hair cells. So here's the control expression, which is by definition unity. 2 hours, 4, 6, and 12 hours later, we can see these 4,000 genes. Some are strongly upregulated, particularly around 4 to 6 hours. Some are strongly downregulated over the same time period. And we're sorting through these now, looking for genes that are involved in interesting developmental processes. We know that Wnt signaling, fibroblast growth factor signaling, and two or three other major signaling pathways are key in the production of hair cells. But we're finding a lot of additional information now about what genes are turned on and off during regeneration. And again, we hope to apply that information later to mammals, including humans. Now, I've again pointed to the fact that these cells have a polarization. They have a short edge and a tall edge. And one other important issue is that the genes that control this are those involved in so-called planar cell polarity. So as many of you know, if you look at many structures, such as the hairs on your arm, the hairs don't go in every which direction, but they are oriented in a particular way. Similarly, on your head, the hairs come out in a particular direction, though they may swirl around some singularity, such as the one on my head. So the genes that are responsible for this are a cluster of core planar cell polarity genes. And I won't go through all of them in detail, but basically these are genes that are involved in cell-cell contact between adjacent cells. So here are two cells in some epithelium, the apical surface and the basal surface. And near the apex of the cell, there's an interaction between particular types of cadherins. This is called flamingo or seltzer. And then particularly between frizzled and Van Gogh, and again, both of them have multiple names. Frizzled is also a receptor for Wnt and wingless proteins, which are extracellular signaling molecules. So these cells can talk to each other by means of this process. There are a number of downstream effectors on both sides. And in brief, what happens is that information flows from cell to cell to cell, rather like dominoes falling over in a game. Each of them signals the one next to it, and by that means they establish a polarization across the whole epithelial surface. And indeed, if one interferes with those genes, the orientation of individual hair cells is disrupted. So here is something called trilobite, which is a mutation of Van Gogh 2, Van Gogh-like 2, and you can see now that the hair cells are not systematically oriented. This one is oriented down, up. This is 5 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and so on. There's a real mess. So those genes are involved in the process. These are various controls in which the orientation is normal. There's something extraordinary that happens when these cells divide in terms of their orientation, and I'll show it in this next movie. This again shows a neuromast with some stained hair cells here. And I want you first to watch this cell down here. It undergoes a division. Then the two daughter cells just sit there. And at the end of the movie, they haven't done much. These are, in fact, two supporting cells, not sensory hair cells. They have green fluorescent protein, as the others do, in their external membrane. The hair cells also have green fluorescent protein in their cytoplasm. I want to contrast that now with another cell here at the top. Watch this cell. It's going to undergo a division soon. Bang. Now watch what the cells do. They start fighting, and they finally end up switching positions. And this is routine. These two are going to become hair cells. You can see they're becoming a little more green than the surrounding cells. They will later look like these. In 70% of the cell replacements, we see the two cells engage in this sort of fight. They undergo a division, then they move back and forth, and 70% of the time they reverse. We do not understand this at all. Why 70%? If it were 50%, it might be a random process. It might be that the cells just, you know, throw dice and then make a choice which direction to move. Half the time they get it right, half the time they get it wrong. Instead, they usually get it wrong, change their minds, and then switch positions. And again, this mechanism is driven by the proteins I mentioned to you before, the proteins of planar cell polarity. So in the mutants, such as trilobite, this dance does not occur normally. The cells simply jiggle around in place, and they do not assume a correct orientation. Here's a diagram showing the same thing for another pair of cells. The supporting cell precursor here simply divides in place, and then the cells sit there quietly. But the hair cell precursor undergoes a division, then the two cells separate and begin to quarrel, to move back and forth, and finally to flip their orientations before they become finally differentiated. So we're trying also to understand what this means in terms of the planar cell polarity. The very last topic I want to talk about is the innervation of these cells. It obviously makes sense for the hair cells of the two orientations to have opposite innervation. So if water is moving this way, it will excite half the hair cells, and they will send information on one nerve fiber. If water moves in the opposite direction, that excites the other half of the hair cells, and they send information in a different nerve fiber. And in fact, that is observed. The innervation looks like this. The nerve fibers have cell bodies, about 40 of them, in a ganglion just behind the ear. They send a nerve fiber into the hindbrain to signal the brain about what's going on. And then each nerve fiber runs along the body and innervates hair cells in one or more neuromasts. It can be anywhere from just one to as many as five, depending on the particular nerve fiber. These nerve fibers grow out with the primordium. So remember, this primordium is migrating along the fish, dropping off neuromasts. At least some of the nerve fibers follow along with the primordium. And as the primordium goes, dropping off neuromasts, the nerve fibers shown in green are already there to innervate it. Here's the next neuromast and the next nerve fiber attaching to that. The pathway that the primordium takes seems to be important in the innervation. There are mutants in which we can interfere with the migration of the primordium. So instead of moving straight towards the fish's tail, it moves in erratic ways. This one moved like that. And if we looked at the nerve fibers and the hair cells at that neuromast, we find that they're both rotated. The nerve fiber is moving north, that is, from bottom to top, rather than from anterior to posterior. And the hair cells are oriented the same way. They're oriented dorsoventrally, not, as they should be, anterior-posterior. Here's another case in which the innervation, in which the nerve fiber has moved down to a neuromast that's not in its correct position. It should be over here. The nerve fiber is oriented downward. The hair cells are also oriented up and down. So somehow, the orientation of the moving primordium determines the final orientation of the hair cells and the final position of the nerve fiber. What seems to happen normally is the primordium moves straight back, and each hair cell is either anterior or posterior in orientation. But in these various mutants, or various treatments we can do, if the primordium moves in an erratic way, the nerve fiber moves with it, and the orientation of the hair cells is also abnormal. So these individual neuromasts are not simply reading out a chemical message that says which is the front and the back of the fish. Instead, they're keeping track of the polarization or the vector of primordium motion, and that vector is then used to set the orientation of the hair cells and the innervation. Now, if we look at an individual neuromass during development, 2.5, 3.5, and 4.5 days, we can again see the fluorescently labeled hair cells. And in this case, we fluorescently labeled a single nerve fiber. This nerve fiber makes a synapse here, or here, and you can see a day later, the synapse is confined to specific cells. It's really clear at 4.5 days. There are synapses here, here, and here. But we don't see any synapses on the opposite side of the neuromass. So this suggests that the single nerve fiber is innervating only hair cells of one polarity. This fiber is innervating these three hair cells, which are oriented to your right, but ignoring the other ones. Excuse me. There will be, of course, another nerve fiber, which we did not label, which will, in fact, innervate the remaining cells. Now, we can confirm that these are, in fact, synapses. We've made a label in which there is M-cherry, a red fluorescent protein, inside the membrane, a membrane spanning section, and then externally, there's horseradish peroxidase. So a cell such as a nerve fiber that expresses this can be seen as a fluorescent preparation such as these. You can see the individual synapses. But after fixation for electron microscopy, one can use horseradish peroxidase to reveal where it was. So here's control nerve. Each of these is an axon, and there's no reaction product. But if we have a neuron that is expressing this construct after reaction, you can see the horseradish peroxidase very nicely outlining it. It's then possible to look at individual putative synapses, such as this one here. When we look at the electron microscope, we can see the presynaptic hair cell, the synaptic ribbon with vesicles around it, and the postsynaptic nerve fiber labeled with horseradish peroxidase. And here's a second nerve fiber at a synapse. Again, the hair cell, the synaptic vesicle, and the labeled postsynaptic nerve fiber. So we're confident that each of these large red things is, in fact, the synapse. The synaptic precision is high, even in regeneration of a hair bundle, even in regeneration of a hair cell. So if we have a normal neuromass such as this one with innervation of these hair cells on the left, we then kill all of the hair cells with a drug. The nerve fiber survives, new hair cells begin to form, and we see immediately that the nerve fiber selects only some of the hair cells. In fact, it ends up selecting just the hair cells that have the same polarity as these hair cells did originally. So the nerve fiber can tell the anteriorly polarized cells from the posteriorly polarized cells. The question is then, how does it do it? You can imagine three rather obvious possibilities. One is activity dependent. One possibility would be that if two hair cells are stimulated by, say, water flow here, these cells will be excited together, and this will somehow cause them to have common innervation. But these other hair cells of the opposite polarity will reject innervation. So this is the fires together, wires together sort of hypothesis. Another possibility is that there's some secret electrical activity, such as oscillation at one frequency or another, that allows these cells to be distinguished from these cells, and again, that the nerve fibers select them on that basis. Or finally, there might be chemical differences. Maybe the hair cells facing to the posterior have one type of label, shown here in orange, and the nerve fibers are attracted to that. The cells here have a different label, shown in blue, and this attracts other nerve fibers. So we've tested these hypotheses by a series of genetic and other techniques. We can, for example, block mechanoelectrical transduction. We can use a mutation that has no protocadherin 15. This, therefore, does not have ordinary tip links. It cannot open and close the synaptic channel, the transduction channels. And yet you see, in this case, there are nonetheless normal innervation, and the cells that have that innervation are all cells of a common polarity. So in this case, the cells facing to your left have been innervated. Here's another mutation, this of a protein called TMIE, for transmembrane inner ear protein. We don't know what it does, but we do know that animals that lack it do not have normal transduction. And again, without normal transduction, we nonetheless get good synapses on these cells. And again, all those cells are of a common orientation. We can block transduction with a drug. This is a Milliride, which blocks the transduction channel. So normally, if we stimulate a hair cell, we would see this strong response in the neuromass. But if we place a Milliride in the bath, we find that that response is blocked. And even after washing it out 2 or 3 days later, we find that there's no response left during stimulation. But the innervation is nonetheless correct. We find that these cells have innervation, and they again correspond to cells of a common orientation. And finally, we can block synaptic transmission. So if we block synaptic transmission by blocking the calcium channels that allow calcium to enter and cause release, we again see normal innervation here, here, and here of cells that have the same polarity. In this case, we've blocked the transporter that puts glutamate into the vesicles. And again, we see these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different cells all have the same orientation over in this other image. So the innervation is always correct, even if we've totally blocked synaptic transmission, even if we've totally blocked transduction at the other end of the cell. And we're left with the idea that there is some sort of chemical specification. During development, even though the orange cell and the blue cell have come from a common precursor, a single mitotic division, there must be some difference that they've acquired that allows one to tell them apart, perhaps a difference associated with their different planar cell polarity. And this is the last thing that we're exploring at present. The idea is to try to select cells of these two different types and to ask whether they express different complements of genes. This is a tricky experiment that's still very much in progress, but it looks like it will bear fruit. We have to go through and, first of all, label these cells genetically with a dye called kaide that some of you may be familiar with. Kaide is apparently Japanese for maple, as in the maple tree, and it's called that because, like maple trees, the leaves turn from green to red during the autumn. In this case, the cells turn from green to red when they're irradiated with short wavelength light. So what's necessary is to go through and in individual neuromasts, look at the cells on the two sides, and then specifically irradiate those that are of one orientation. So these would all be cells oriented to your right. These would be cells oriented to your left. We then separately collect the red and the green cells and do genetic analysis of what messages and what proteins they're expressing. And again, I'm sorry to say this work is very much in progress. As I said, we're seeing some interesting things. We found a number of proteins that seem to be specifically in one class and not the other, but we haven't yet finished doing the functional tests by knocking out those particular genes or by using mutations when they're available to ask what their role is in this process. So I'd leave this as a work in progress. So this is all I have to say, and I'd like to thank all of you once again for coming to this series of lectures. It's been a great pleasure and a privilege for me. Thank you for your attention.